Monitor. 4 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, 2000 hours Greenwich Mean Time. This is Monitor, reporting the nation and the world. The combined radio and television networks of the National Broadcasting Company bring you the premier broadcast of Monitor, the new NBC radio service originating from NBC's Electronic Communication Center, Radio Central, New York. Now, to introduce Monitor to America, here is the president of the National Broadcasting Company, Mr. Sylvester L. Weaver.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Monitor, our new NBC weekend radio service. This is a preview, which will be seen on television for the next hour, and it'll be heard on radio until midnight tonight, New York time. But beginning next week, Monitor will start each Saturday morning at 8 o'clock New York time and run until midnight on Sunday. It will bring you a continuous flow of items of high interest and information. Monitor is for all of you, wherever you are, in your cars, at home, at the beach, with your portables, everywhere. And on Monitor, we are going to throw away the radio clock. We are going to bring you what we hope is the radio pattern of the future. News and information and entertainment in the vignette form, where the items are as long as they need to be or as short. Well, over a weekend, there'll be a 100 people serving you from Radio Central here. And among them and here today for you to meet are Dave Garraway and Bob and Ray, Morgan Beatty, Walter Kiernan, Clifton Fadiman, Ben Grauer, and many, many others. Now, including in this group, we have our executive producer of Monitor, a man who has been a part of a number of great pioneering ventures in NBC, Jim Fleming. Jim, I've talked about something about the show that we're going to have today. Perhaps you'd better tell us about the people and the places that we're going to be hearing in the next hour.
Well, thank you, Pat. In a moment, we're going to turn our live cameras and microphones to the West Coast, to Hermosa Beach, California, where a Sunday afternoon jazz concert's underway. Then up the coast we go, and we're going to a place where there is no freedom. That would be San Quentin Prison.
San Quentin?
San Quentin.
We going inside?
Inside, well, yes, Monitor goes places.
So long as we don't have to stay. Well, now, what about sports today?
Well, the most unusual sports commentator in the business is standing by at his favorite tavern.
News and opinion.
Well, we'll have the late headlines, comments by columnist Roscoe Drummond from Washington. Istanbul's coming up on the circuit.
And travel?
A plane is standing by at this moment to go nonstop to London from Idlewild Airport. A Monitor transmitter is aboard.
Good enough. What about entertainment?
Well, Art Van Dam Quintet live from Chicago. Jerry Lewis filmed in the Catskills. Live summer theater pickup, Bucks County, Pennsylvania.
What about philosopher and thinkers?
Well, we have yourself, sir.
Well, now, let's steady. Let's talk about what we've really got.
Well, not to mention President Pusey of Harvard and Bill Saltonstall of Phillips Exeter.
Oh, yes. Well, I think you've already gotten into vignettes and what's ahead. Let's talk about what's first.
Well, the top news headlines of this hour, and here is Dave Garraway.
And here are those headlines. From Bonn, West German Chancellor Adenauer is flying to Washington for talks with President Eisenhower. He is due there tomorrow. From Detroit, midnight strike deadline approaching as GM and officials of the United Auto Workers Union seek to settle their dispute. From Sumter, South Carolina, the Ku Klux Klan is out of hiding, holds its first open meeting in 3 years. And from Le Mans in France, the greatest auto tragedy in history, 85 dead in the crash of the sports car race at Le Mans, about 100 miles southwest of Paris.
And Dave, when this crash occurred, Monitor was there with BBC's reporter, Mr. Baxter, Raymond Baxter, and this is his broadcast a moment after that crash happened that killed so many at Le Mans.
This is Monitor, second hour, Monitor at Radio Central, New York. Your communicator, Clifton Fadiman. It's 5 o'clock here in New York, give or take 10 seconds or so. Early afternoon in San Francisco. Morning mists are still clinging to the waters of Pearl Harbor. In the next 60 minutes, Monitor will swing aboard one of the world's greatest liners now in mid-ocean, the SS United States. We'll ride with a giant trans-world airliner somewhere between New York's Idlewild Airport and London. We'll go to a Greenwich Village nightclub for live Dixieland Monitor music and pace the corridors of San Quentin Prison. Now, Don Russell and the Monitor headlines.
Bonn, Germany. Chancellor Adenauer arrives in Washington tomorrow for talks with President Eisenhower and Big Three foreign ministers. Detroit, General Motors appears headed for agreement with auto workers before midnight strike deadline. Washington, Senator McClellan calls for investigation of nest of grafters in military procurement. Le Mans, France. Mike Hawthorne, British driver, wins Le Mans 24-hour race as death toll in sports car crash reaches 85. Those are the Monitor headlines.
This is Monitor, reporting the nation and the world. In the next hour, we'll go behind the bars of San Quentin Prison, travel to London on a constellation, hear Dixieland music from Nick's in Greenwich Village, visit backstage with Mary Martin and Helen Hayes, go to press with the Chicago Sun-Times, interview Victor Borge, Bob Hope, and Gregory Rathoff, and much more. On hand is Monitor's major pickup, a report from inside the maximum security prison of San Quentin. It's now lockup time, and for the latest hourly report, Monitor goes to Walter McGraw in San Quentin Prison. This is Monitor, and this is Ben Grauer. We've been to San Quentin Prison and to Nick's for Dixieland music. And for the next 3 minutes, Monitor will go to the city desk of the Chicago Sun-Times to catch a news story coming in. Come along to a Monitor remote in Chicago and John Chancellor.
The sanctum sanctorum of any big metropolitan daily newspaper is the city room. Here's where the news report is carved and polished out of the raw and rough forms of the day's unprocessed news. The eye of this editorial hurricane is the city desk, and that's where Monitor is now, at the city desk of the Chicago Sun-Times. The morning paper, the first edition is called A Bulldog in Chicago, has just come up, and the presses six floors below us are rolling out the press run. The lead story here in Chicago is slugged GM, General Motors. Donald Schwartz, the Sun-Times staff man in Detroit, has a Dateline story saying General Motors and union negotiators appear to have averted a General Motors strike in a bargaining session that reportedly brought agreement on a guaranteed wage. This is getting top play in the first edition.
Now, if you'd like to pull your chair up a little closer to the loudspeaker, I wouldn't blame you at all. If you'd like to get inside the set, I wouldn't blame you very much. There's going to be some very deep breathing going on here. Old friend Monitor and Garraway are host right now to the very likes of Miss Marilyn Monroe.
I wonder if I'm scared of you. Are most men scared of you? I'm not sure whether I should be frightened of you or not.
No, nobody's scared of me.
I don't know. I bet a lot of guys are scared of you, though, because you're such an institution now. Really, you are. You're a kind of a national possession. Do you feel that you belong to the nation as a whole?
I don't know quite what you mean by that. I live here.
That'll do it very nicely. I heard you were smart, but I didn't know.
I'm not.
Yes, you are.
Don't let me fool you. I'm not.
You know, you have a reputation as among the great mass of people. I think it's probably the most beautiful blonde in the world, but a kind of a dumb girl because you're a beautiful blonde. And blondes and dumbness seem to go together. I think it all started with maybe with gentlemen prefer blondes.
You know, it's interesting that people associate, if you happen to have blonde hair, you know, naturally or not naturally, however, or if you're not out of shape in some way, you're absolutely dumb. I mean, you're considered dumb. I don't know why that is. I think it's a very limited view.
It isn't true, I'm sure.
Well, I mean, it doesn't matter what the person, what they look like, what color hair they have.
Nonsense.
Or if they happen not to be out of shape. I mean, my time's to come. Gravity catches up with all of us.
Yes. Slowly, but I'm afraid inexorably, if that's the right word.
Ben Grauer back at NBC's Radio Central, back from Birdland and the songs of Al Hibbler. Speaking of Birdland, let's see, speaking of Birdland. Yes, there at the end of our great massive communicators bench, here's a bird that just landed, our television monitor, Henry Morgan.
Thank you, Ben. Good evening, anybody. Here's Morgan with a fantastic new public service. We figure that a lot of people are out of town on weekends and miss their favorite TV programs, so I'm here to bring you up to date on what you didn't see. Well, first today, on your behalf, I watched the first hour of Monitor, this program. It was on both radio and TV, you know. It was sort of interesting. I liked it. It started with somebody introducing Mr. Weaver, I think his name was, the president of NBC. And Mr. Weaver, is it, introduced to Mr. Fleming. And Mr. Fleming introduced Garraway. And after a while, they introduced Clifton Fadiman. And during the hour it was on TV, everybody introduced something. One man introduced Hermosa Beach. One introduced Idlewild Airport. One introduced a quintet from Chicago. It's a new thing in radio. They now use five famous people to say what one lonesome announcer used to say years ago. Sometime during the show, they took us up to Harvard to meet the president. He has a very tiny mouth, in case you missed the TV part. Teeny-weeny little mouth. He had a spiritual message. He said that churches were being built by leaps and bounds, but he didn't say whether anybody was going to them. Bob and Ray were on a couple of times, but the funniest part of the show, I think, was when they switched to Chicago for the Art Van Dam Quintet. The quintet started playing some very high-class music, about eight bars, and all of a sudden, a very sexy woman's voice said, "The temperature in Aberdeen, Scotland, is 51, cloudy. Madrid, 68, cloudy." And she went all around the world, so that when she finished, the quintet was finished, and we came back to New York. Now, on TV, you didn't see the girl, incidentally, you just heard her. So in case you missed the TV show, you didn't miss anything. She wasn't there. Now, I'm what? Oh, I see. I've just been handed a bulletin. Your services no longer are required for the... Oh, well, actually, the job done in general on Monitor was simply sensational, but it's not my business to say so.
The clock keeps on moving, drawing closer now to the midnight hour here at Radio Central in New York. For the past 8 hours, this has been the premiere of Monitor, your ear to the world and all of its happenings. We have... Obviously, that was one final sound our engineer had left over. I don't know what it is or where in the past 8 hours you were supposed to have heard it, but we wouldn't want you to think that we had held anything back. Here at Radio Central, we've done our best to monitor the world for you as you combed the sand and salt out of your hair on a Carolina beach, as you made your way back into Chicago, bumper to bumper down to old Highway 12, or as you rocketed your way by track train from Tulsa to Kansas City for that important Monday morning appointment.
Wherever you've spent this lovely spring weekend, Monitor, direct and transcribed, has been your Sunday companion this June 12, 1955. We hope that you'll be with us next weekend when Monitor will be your companion for a full 40 hours, doing things and going places. Next weekend, we monitor the world by taking you to San Francisco for the National Open Golf Tournament, to Fort Bragg, North Carolina, for the thrills of a mass parachute jump, to the birthplace of the United Nations, for the UN's 10th birthday party. We take you around the world for a look-in on June weddings around the world. There'll be these features and dozens more next weekend for 40 hours, starting on Saturday at 8 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time. And now, this is Ben Brower.
Walter Carradine.
Morgan Beatty.
And Miss Monitor.
All of us saying good night.
Good night.
This is Monitor, NBC's new radio service.
Don't move, just leave your dial out and look here at Monitor. Lean back and stay a while now and look here at Monitor. Put NBC.
Da-da-da-da-da-dee-dum. Holiday Morgan coming to you from Holiday Rockefeller Center.
This is Monitor, this is your weekend show. Stay with Monitor, nationwide radio.
Hi, this is Frank Sinatra, Jr.
Good evening. This is Frank McGee, back with a special half hour that is, we think, likely to stir the memories of hundreds of thousands of Monitor listeners.
You'll find us good listening. Monitor is on the air.
And I'm Jim Lowe with you on the second Sunday in August.
From coast to coast.
Yeah.
Here's Monitor.
Sing that thing. Go ahead.
The Bergen
Group, yes. Ladies and gentlemen, it is I. My writer has, it's me. But then again, what does he know about grammar? It is I. Yes, Ted Brown.
Well, I'm traveling down life's highway and things are going my way. I'm happy as a lark and fancy free. There's good reason why, my friend, my heart's singing each weekend. I spend time with Monitor and NBC.
Here's Monitor now on NBC.
And welcome again to the Big M, where we have a lot going for you. This is Bill Cullen, an exception to the foregoing.
Here's Hunter.
Here's Morgan.
What if the winter brings ice and snow?
Monitor warms your heart, makes you glow.
You won't mind freezing if you spend the season with NBC.
I said Murray the K, and I'll be back after What's Next.
News time is coming up now. Ba 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 ba. Monitor Radio. Monitor Radio.
Go north or south, go east or west. Just get in your car.
This is the NBC Radio Network.
NBC will be your host in 1970.
That's right, next year, as in all the years before, NBC is the place to be, and this is Gene Rayburn inviting you to be there with me.
NBC 1970. Ba 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 ba. Monitor Radio. Monitor.
Yes, yes, 1970 Morgan too.
It's Monitor in 1970.
News on the hour in just a few moments coming up here. Gene Rayburn. Monitors ring around the world, focusing this weekend on President Nixon's European trip, which begins tomorrow. For a report on one aspect of preparations being made in London, here is Ray Shear, NBC News in the British capital.
When I asked one random Londoner today what he makes of the Nixon visit here beginning Monday evening, the man said, "Why is your new president traveling over here so early? Is he coming to tell us something?" Our answer was that Mr. Nixon is mainly trying to tell Europe that he is interested in Europe, and that he is coming more to listen and learn than to bring any message. To many Europeans, as the Weekly Spectator puts it this weekend, Mr. Nixon is an object of suspicion, the antithesis of the Kennedys, without great wealth or glamour or sophistication or Ivy League scriptwriters. The Weekly magazine says he represents the middle-class America of the suburbs, with whom Europeans are most familiar and therefore most unfairly contemptuous as tourists. But the magazine goes on to say that what Mr. Nixon has said about Europe in the brief period since his inauguration offers the hope that his could be the first administration since the war to treat us at our own valuation. That is a fair summary of what the literate Briton seems to think about Mr. Nixon. The president will try to reverse the process, so the dispatches from Washington indicate, by holding private meetings with ordinary citizens while he is here in London as well as in other capitals. The citizens are being selected by Ambassador David Bruce, who soon retires in favor of Mr. Nixon's friend Walter Annenberg. One gets the impression, talking to embassy officials, that rather than ordinary citizens, Mr. Nixon will sit down with carefully chosen distinguished people, be they tradesmen, union members, students, journalists, doctors, lawyers, or candlestick makers. The list of those chosen to meet with the president here Tuesday is a confidential matter, for one thing, to spare the sensibilities of those not so chosen. One British couple who live in neighboring Surrey called the American Embassy and volunteered their company, saying they felt certain they were two ordinary citizens Mr. Nixon would like to spend an hour with. The offer has been declined with thanks. Ray Shearer, NBC News, London.
Monitors ring around the world, this week concentrating on President Nixon's trip to Europe. We'll have reports from some of the other host cities later today. And in a few moments, we'll bring you a sampling of opinions by Washingtonians concerning the wisdom of the president's making the trip.
On the line with Bob Considine, brought to you by Mutual of Omaha, the company that pays.
Dateline, Dayton, Ohio, February 27, 1920. Major R.W. Schroeder set a new altitude record today of 33,113 feet. His biplane, powered with a 400-horsepower Liberty engine, is the Army's first airplane designed to penetrate the unknown of extreme altitudes. That story sent a shiver of excitement through this country in 1920. I'll be back with a somewhat more shivery adventure due to begin on February 28, 1969. But first, here's something to remember from Mutual of Omaha.
What do you do when your pay ain't there? Where do you go in the open air? There's gotta be a way to protect it all. Gotta be a place if the snow should fall.
All of us depend on our paychecks, don't we? But what would happen if your paychecks stopped coming in? Would it mean giving up all you've worked to build? Not if you have paycheck protection from Mutual of Omaha. If sickness or accident keeps you from working, Mutual of Omaha can send you an emergency paycheck every month to call him today.
Returning from what was then considered outer space on February 27, 1920, Army Air Corps pilot Major Schroeder said, "The cold, thin air is one's greatest adversary. At 20,000 feet, while still climbing in large circles, it was wonderful to see the very clear blue sky with the clouds thousands of feet below. As I went higher, frost formed on my goggles, and I had to remove my glove to put the warm palm of my hand on the glass to thaw the frost. Near 29,000 feet, the thermometer showed 32 degrees below zero centigrade." People of that time said, "By golly, that's the limit. Let's have no more of that." Well, a congressman who was opposed to having the government put up another cent for the development of America's supersonic airliner, which will fly twice as high as Major Schroeder and 18 times faster, was quoted not long ago as saying, "I don't want to go any place at 1,800 miles an hour. All I want to do is fly at 600 miles an hour, like the good Lord intended." A recent Harris poll showed that almost half of those questioned were opposed to Project Apollo. Harris quoted one of those questioned as stating, "God never intended us to go into space." Probably was a flat earth believer. I attended a briefing the other day on what Apollo 9 is expected to accomplish during its 10 days in Earth orbit, 115 miles out there. It must take the wraps off the lunar module, in which the first men will ride down to the lunar surface, perhaps this summer. Apollo 9's lunar module will undergo its first manned test. It will be cut loose in space with two astronauts aboard, drift a little more than 100 miles from the command module, which will be under the control of the third astronaut on the mission, and then the two must get back together again. Sounds simple, but it's the most hair-raising and complex mission attempted so far in the space age. If there's no rendezvous, the two astronauts in the lunar module die in space when their oxygen runs out, and the hope of a lunar landing will be shattered for months or even years to come. But presuming that all goes well, as we pray, the two men will climb back into the command module. The lunar module will then be kicked loose, and everybody will go to sleep, having put in an 18-hour day with no overtime. This is Bob Considine for Monitor. Now let's hear from Mutual of Omaha.
I'm not sure if the opinion pollsters have ever sampled voter preference on the basis of love and hate, but Al Capp has thought about it, obviously, for here he is, Monitor's expert on nothing with opinions on everything.
Love is so much more popular than hate. It's so much more highly spoken of that sometimes you can't help wondering if there isn't a conspiracy of newspaper columnists, radio and TV commentators, and certain magazines brainwashing the public into regarding it as a nicer emotion. Among other complimentary things often said about love is that it conquers all, it makes the world go round, and that it can accomplish miracles. And all that's true except on Election Day. Because, more often than not, on Election Day, the haters conquer. The haters grab the power to make the world go round, and generally backwards. On Election Day, it's often hate and not love that accomplishes miracles. The reason for that is that hate is violent stuff to be loaded with. The hater doesn't relax and enjoy life. All that hate boiling inside of him makes it impossible for him to relax. You show me someone who hates, and I'll show you someone who's lively. Those haters are always up and at it, and they're up and at it earliest and hardest on Election Day. You show me a guy who loves life, and I'll show you one who's secure, who's relaxed, or in a word, who's lazy. And that's a fine way to be after hours, except for about 20 minutes every 4 years on November 3rd. If those of us who love America more than we hate the few inconveniences that come with being an American, if we don't express that love by giving those 20 minutes to protect the America we love on November the 3rd, the haters will take over, as they've taken over so many relaxed nations before. In this time of unreasoning, unreasonable hate, going to the polls can be something more than a duty. It can be an act of love. This is Al Capp speaking to you on NBC's Monitor.
You're right, Al. Monitor's editorial cartoonist without portfolio, Al Capp.
At the Monitor Sports Desk now, Mel Allen with Today in Sports.
Thank you very much, Brad. Hello there, everybody. Lee Trevino, keep the name in mind, was just a $30 a week driving range assistant pro a year ago. Today, Lee Trevino is the U.S. Open champion and $30,000 richer. He won his first tournament by four strokes. That's the incredible rags-to-riches story of Mexican-American Lee Trevino, a 28-year-old gravedigger's grandson who's a blithe spirit along the lines of, well, of Tony Lima. And he ordered a tequila party for the press to celebrate his victory. Trevino started the day one stroke behind leader Bert Yancey. He made the turn one stroke ahead and then applied the knockout on 11 and 12, sinking birdie putts of 35 and 20 feet. Trevino finished with a 69 for a tournament record, tying record, I should say, of 275, and in the process became the first man in open history to post four subpar rounds. The first three were 69, 68, and 69. With Bert Yancey collapsing with a 76 and a 281 for third, defending champion Jack Nicklaus made a charge and finished second with a 279 on a 67. Nicklaus posted the 275 tournament record in winning last year. On the monitor baseball scoreboard in the National League, St. Louis beat Cincinnati 4-2. Ray Washburn beat George Culver. Atlanta beat Chicago 1-0, 11 innings. Jim Britton beat Chuck Hartenstein. Los Angeles beat Philadelphia 2-1. Claude Osteen, the winning pitcher, and Rick Wise, the loser. This was Bob Skinner's debut as Phil's manager. Rick Wise homered in his behalf for Philadelphia. The Giants and Mets split in the first game of a doubleheader. San Francisco beat the Mets 4-1. Ray Sadecki, the winning pitcher, and Dick Selma, the loser. Jack Hyde hit a home run for the Giants, so did Willie Mays. It was Mays' 12th of the season and career number 576. Cleon Jones homered for the Mets. In the second game, New York beat the San Francisco Giants 3-1. Danny Frisella beating Bill Henry. Art Shamsky of the Mets hit a home run, and the Mets drew a crowd of almost 55,000 to Shea Stadium for the doubleheader. The Pirates swept the Astros in the first game of doubleheader. It was 3-1, Steve Blass beating Mike Cuellar. Mike Cuellar homered for Houston. And in the second game, Pittsburgh won it 11-2. Tommy Sisk, the winning pitcher, and Larry Dericker, the losing pitcher. Jim Wynn homered for the Astros. In the American League, the White Sox and Tigers split. Chicago won the first game 3-2. Hoyt Wilhelm beat Mickey Lolich. Tommy Davis homered for the White Sox. And in the second game, 6-1, Denny McClain beating Cisco Carlos. Boston took Cleveland 5-3. Bill Landis in relief of Jim Lomborg, who made his first start since the World Series and gave up only three singles in five innings. Mike Paul was the losing pitcher. Rico Petrocelli and Ken Harrelson homered for Boston. Minnesota beat Washington 4-2. Dave Boswell beat Jim Hannon. Cesar Tovar for the Twins and Ron Hansen for the Senators hit home runs. Senators have now lost five in a row. The Yankees beat California 4-3. Fritz Peterson beat Ricky Clark. Horace Clark and Mickey Mantle homered for the Yankees. Mantle's ninth of the year, career number 527. Rick Reichardt homered for the Angels. And Oakland beat Baltimore 4-2. Chuck Dobson beat Pete Rickert. Mike Hershberger homered for the A's, and Fred Valentine and Kurt Bleffrey for the Orioles. That's what is and will be in sports, Brad. Mel Allen here, friends, reminding you that for more features and news from the world of sports, stay tuned to Monitor.
Thank you, Mel.
There's a considerable distance between players and owners in baseball today over proposed pension funds, but that's not the distance Joe Garagiola is concerned with now in Monitor Sports.
How far is the distance from home plate to first base? Well, for a guy in a slump, it can seem like 4 miles and all uphill. Actually, the rule book says that it's 90 feet, but it may not say that for too much longer. Recently, Congress authorized the National Bureau of Standards to conduct a study to determine the probable costs and the benefits to the nation of joining the international trend to measuring distances in meters rather than in feet or yards. If it were adopted, it could make a difference in a lot of sports, but baseball might feel it more than most. Now, your initial reaction might be the track would be the sport most affected, but most international and Olympic track distances are already measured in meters. But baseball would really have to make a choice. Should the distance from base to base be 27 meters? That would make the distance shorter than it is now. 28 meters would be longer. And while the pitchers might vote for that, this would be a tough year to get that rule passed. The third choice would be that home plate to first base would measure 27.4320 meters. I bet the groundkeepers would love that. You'd need a college degree to lay down a foul line. With the recent switch by England and Japan, only four countries now use the measurements that are most familiar to Americans. Actually, the most resistance to such a change is apt to come from the sports world, even more than from industry, commerce, or science. Can't you just see two golfers playing for their club championship? They both hit big drives, and Jones says to Smith, "Go ahead and hit. You're away." Smith just smiles and says, "If we measure, I think you'll find that I hit my drive just a silly millimeter longer." Whether the National Bureau of Standards will recommend the change is still not known. If they do, there's no telling when it would become effective. In England, it doesn't take effect until 1980. Would I care to make a prediction? Tell you something, that's one I wouldn't touch with a 3-meter pole. This is Joe Garagiola from Monitor Sports.
"'Tis the season to be jolly, but Henry Morgan is having none of it, thank you. Despite a severe cold, fever, chills, and sore throat, Henry proves that a little case of grip will never alter his terminal case of gripe. Here he is, Ebenezer Morgan."
"I have this theory about Christmas trees. It's a pretty good theory because I checked with a few people and they say it's accurate. It's even better than a theory, it's true. I feel that when you buy a nice straight Christmas tree, it's a nice straight tree all the way home. When you finally get it up, it's not a straight tree. End of theory. My next theory has to do with Christmas tree lights. Now, it says on the box they come in, if one light goes out, it makes no difference. The rest will stay lit. And now, that may be true. I don't know. Because the way it works for me is that they all go out and they stay out, and I can never find out what's wrong. Doesn't happen to be a theory either. It's another fact. All right, hold that. I want to tell you something else. There's an idea I had the other day that I didn't do anything about, and I'm sorry I didn't, so I'll tell you what it was, and we can both forget it. I was going to call up Johnny Carson, see? And I'd say, "John, I haven't been on the show for about 2 years or so. I want to come over tonight and just do 2 minutes and leave." And then I'd go on Carson's show, see? And I'd sit down and say, "Listen, John, as you know, I've been a bachelor for some years now, and I've been sort of thinking that I've been a bachelor long enough. How much do you charge for weddings around here?" Then I'd explain that it wouldn't be a big wedding, just the girl and me and our friend. Maybe one flower. No organ or anything. A clerk from City Hall will get the whole thing over with in a couple of minutes and not make a big deal out of it. Well, then, see, I'd go on Merv Griffin's show and David Frost's show and Dave Garraway's show and get competitive prices. Of course, the only trouble with the scheme is, if I got a good deal going, I'd have to go out and find a girl. And once I'd found the girl, I'd have to talk her into marrying me. And the only way I figure I could do that would be to promise her 2 tickets to the Carson show. This is Henry Morgan. Single, free, bad throat, little stupid."
Our resident psychologist, Dr. Joyce Brothers, receives a lot of mail from listeners who have problems of one kind or another. Right now, she's going to answer one of those letters. Doctor?
A woman writes, "Dear Dr. Brothers, I show my love for my husband in countless ways. Always making his favorite foods, and in general, trying to make his life a little less harried. But he still acts as if I'm the most selfish and inconsiderate person in the world if I don't feel like having sex when he does. He sulks like a baby without trying to understand that I'm sometimes just too tired or in a bad mood. What should I do? It's only natural that a husband or wife will occasionally feel little interest in sex while the partner is favorably inclined. However, such differences in sexual interest should only become a major marital problem when it becomes a frequent occurrence. Wives sometimes fail to understand the impact that fairly regular sexual refusal or postponement can have upon their husband's confidence and emotional well-being. Instead of trying to understand the feelings of their husband and to consider possible reasons for their own continued reluctance, they find it easier to deny the existence of any problem at all. No matter how deeply a husband loves his wife, frequent rejections of his sexual overtures can cause resentment and anger, which can lead to serious marital problems. Some men attempt to solve the dilemma by seeking out a more accepting, regularly responsive woman with whom they can be relatively certain that their sexual advances will be welcome. Or a man may gradually decrease the frequency with which he approaches his wife in order to reduce the possibility of disappointment and rejection. Ironically, the sexually rejecting wife is very often an excellent wife in a motherly sense, taking care of all of her husband's needs except his sexual needs. While you may believe that you amply demonstrate your love through cooking and caretaking efforts, obviously your husband can't help but feel your frequent coolness as a sign of lack of love. both of you should sit down and talk about this as soon as possible. And I think you should make an effort to be more accepting if you don't want your husband to stray. This is Dr. Joyce Brothers for Monitor.
I got a problem, too, at home. I've got a problem there, personal problem. I guess I shouldn't discuss it. I won't discuss it because my wife would cut me off without a cent. Thank you, Doctor. Dr. Brothers welcomes letters from Monitor listeners. You may address her in care of NBC Monitor, 30 Rockefeller Plaza, New York. Here's a new release, Let's Change the Subject, by Peggy Lee, which almost always means something pleasurable. This one's called Where Did They Go?
Now, Monitor, good grooming tip. When you wash sweaters, wash them inside out, and you'll lessen the amount of matting and pilling, those fuzzy bits that appear on a sweater's surface after they've been worn a while. Incidentally, to remove those bits, use a wire brush. Now, another good grooming tip, and it's really something, a bath oil so reasonably priced that it can't be called a luxury. Capri Foaming Bath Oil. Next time you bathe, add it to your tub and make bathing a beautiful, relaxing experience. Capri conditions even the hardest water, foams it, never leaves a tub ring. It's great to use during the winter months because Capri's coconut oil base softens and smooths dry skin. So make a note. Capri Foaming Bath Oil with a good housekeeping seal. It's a real buy.
And now a look at the world of Broadway by Monitor's Man on the Isle, who here examines the off-Broadway scene and interviews novelist-turned-playwright Norman Mailer.
With no openings on Broadway this week, theatrical activity moved to off-Broadway, where two new plays are stirring up a lot of interest. They are Norman Mailer's The Deer Park and McBird. McBird is the most incendiary political satire in a long time. McBird began preview performances this Thursday night, and it's already been called notorious. It also has a $10,000 advance ticket sale, possibly the heaviest in off-Broadway history. McBird is the first play by 25-year-old Barbara Garson, and it's based roughly on Shakespeare's tragedy, Macbeth. President Lyndon Johnson is McBird, and John Kennedy, Kennodunk, the murdered king. The play, which has been praised by some critics, pictures McBird as a cruel, ambitious, and power-hungry ruler. Because of its content, the play has met with a number of obstacles. First, no publisher would print it, so it was printed privately, and it's now sixth on the paperback bestseller list. Then, two theaters turned it down, so it's being staged at a huge Greenwich Village cafe, the first drama ever done there. Then the printer, who normally prints the playbills for off-Broadway, refused to handle it. So Grove Press, which has purchased the publishing rights to the play, is also printing the playbill for the first time. McBird officially opens February the 8th. Norman Mailer, novelist, journalist, and poet, is about to open his first play. It's an adaptation of his novel, The Deer Park. I talked to Mr. Mailer, whose play was scheduled to open this Tuesday night.
It was supposed to open this Tuesday night, but we've delayed 1 week. We're going to open on the 31st of January.
Why the one-week delay?
Well, first of all, because the 31st is my birthday. But the real reason we're delaying is that we think we may have something extraordinary. We've been getting better every day, and we decided to go this extra week because we think if we do, we're within shooting distance of having something very large, like Death of a Salesman or Streetcar or Virginia Woolf.
What do you gain beside the time in a week? I mean, why 1 week? Why not 2 weeks? Why not 2 days? How do you decide how long to postpone an opening?
A theater company is really more like an athletic team than a group of artists. In other words, theater has more to do with sports than it has to do with writing. And it's just as if you were getting a team ready for its first game of the season. And each day, the plays are made better. In other words, if you have 3 or 4 weeks before the season starts, it's obviously a great advantage if you have 5 weeks rather than 3 weeks before a season starts. Because every day, what happens is the plays are made better.
No matter when you decide to open, when you do open, one thing that goes for sure is that in that opening night audience, there will be a lot of critics. What do you think of the value of the critics? Do we need critics?
I wrote something on the Times about this, which came out today, as a matter of fact. I think we need critics. I think that critics provide a dramatic edge.
Norman Mailer, who will celebrate his birthday on opening night and possibly celebrate the critics' reaction to his play. Leonard Probst, NBC News, New York. And that's it from Broadway.
Jules Pfeiffer, the satiric cartoonist, is incisive, he's wicked, and he's witty. And it all shows in the new movie based on his play called Little Murders, which is a triumph of dark humor. Little Murders takes place in New York City. Elliot Gould plays a professional photographer who takes pictures of nothing but excrement. Well, he sure came to the right city. Gould calls himself an apathist. He is loaded with apathy. He is so apathetic that when the movie begins, Gould is just standing in the street letting a bunch of hooligans beat him up. He's rescued by a girl who is definitely not an apathist. She is an interior designer, and she is a doist. She's not satisfied that she rescued him. Now she wants to save him. Naturally, he falls in love with her. So she rushes him home to meet the family in their apartment in Manhattan. To Mommy, who's a nut. To Daddy, who's also a nut. And to her younger brother, who, with a little luck, could become a complete disaster. This is New York, after all, so when all the lights go out in the apartment, everybody keeps right on talking. When shots are heard outside the window, nobody even notices. The movie is off to a wildly farcical start, but then a special shot rings out, triggering the story into terror, which somehow remains murderously funny. In the leading role, Elliot Gould does a bang-up job. Alan Arkin plays a frustrated detective who's an over-enthusiastic interrogator. Arkin also directed Little Murders, and he directs as well as he acts, and there's not much more I can say about anybody, because that is very good indeed. There are two uproarious set pieces. Lou Jacoby plays a judge who delivers a nutty tirade from the bench, and there's Donald Sutherland, who plays a self-ordained priest of the First Existential Church. He's outrageously funny, giving a wedding oration that could easily alter the course of marriage. This is really some movie, because Little Murders rifles the mindlessness of Manhattan and comes up loaded with laughs. This is Gene Shalit for Monitor.
In Atlanta, the temperature is 79, partly cloudy. Spokane, 68, cloudy. Milwaukee, 68, fog. Baltimore, 80, thunderstorms. San Diego, 72, partly cloudy. Winston-Salem, 80, cloudy. Detroit, 72, rain. Akron, 71, thunderstorms. Newark, 73, cloudy. Las Vegas, 97, very warm.
And that's Miss Monitor, one of the original features on Monitor. Sometimes it's copied by other programs, too. And once, in fact, the object of Bob and Ray's attention. Well, see, that was always one of the great things about working on Monitor. You weren't allowed to take yourself too seriously. And that included our beloved Miss M. Listen.
Bob and Ray back at Monitor in New York, and a little bit earlier today we had an Indian guest who was here in connection with the pickup from Fort Bragg, the parachute jump, and his name is Geronimo. He seems to have taken quite an interest in radio operation.
Mm. Here are temperature around Wild West.
We hadn't planned this,
Whiskey
Geronimo.
Whiskey Butte, Montana, 89.
Whiskey Butte?
Batman, North Dakota, 103. Noose, Nebraska, 98.
Well, look, I'm not so sure whether we really need this
Stay
kind
quiet.
Of...
Six Gun, Nevada, 87. Shane, Colorado, 64 degree. Mayhem, many buffalo. But bow and arrow.
Oh, this is the last time we'll book an Indian on this show.
Hello.
Hello, Nancy?
No, it isn't. I'm sorry, you have the wrong number.
Is this Rector 44445?
No, it isn't.
Oh, I'm sorry. But don't hang up.
Why not?
Well, I don't know. You sound very nice.
Thank you. You've got the wrong number. Why don't you try dialing again?
Well, what number is this?
This is not Rector 4445, whatever you said it was.
I don't understand, because I am dialing Rector 44445.
Why don't you call the operator? What a wonderful idea that might be.
Well, now, listen, don't get angry.
I'm not angry.
Well, What number is this?
This is not Rector 44445.
Yeah, but I didn't say what it was, and I said, what is it?
Well, it isn't what you want.
Well, we don't know that.
Yes, we do. We know that very well. I know that. Now, I'd like you to know it, too, and then we can know it. It'll be a secret that we share.
What do you look like?
I'm very beautiful.
Well, you don't sound like you're very busy right now.
Yes, I'm not very busy. I have nothing at all to do.
Well, maybe you'd like to make a new friend.
No, I don't think so. I have enough friends as it is. Too many.
Are you sure?
Quite positive.
Well, aren't you even curious about me?
No, not at all.
But listen, this might be the big thing in your life.
Yes, it might. What a pity, because I'm going to have to miss it.
But why don't you take a chance? Listen, why don't you let me come up and you take a look at me, and if you don't like me, you can just slam the door in my face. Now, that's a deal.
It's not necessary. I don't like you from talking to you.
Then why haven't you hung up?
Oh, what a good idea.
It was a terrific race. The weather was clear, and the people gave quite an ovation to Buddy Werner when he came in his last effort to unseat the champion.
Where's McClough's?
What?
Where the hell is the clothes? Will you identify yourself and say, and now back to Monitor and Radio Central.
All right. Ready? I'll take five. This is Kid Carson White, the ski reporter from San Francisco. I'd like to return you back to Monitor and San Francisco.
Look, Kid, you say this. Your name is Kit Carson White?
Yes.
Would you please say, this is Kit Carson White in Squaw Valley, now back to Monitor and Radio Central.
All right. This is Kit Carson White from Squaw Valley, now back to Radio Monitor.
Let's try it again. It's Monitor and Radio Central.
Monitor in Radio Central. All right. This is Kit Carson White, Squaw Valley. And now back to Radio Monitor in Central.
Kid, let's try it slow this time, huh?
Well, let me write it. There's some people.
It's Monitor and Radio Central.
Monitoring Radio Central. All right. This is Kit Carson White from Squaw Valley, and now back to Monitor and Radio Central.
3 hours top story, a Senate vote today on a tax reform bill becomes questionable because an unknown number of amendments must be disposed of first. Dean Mel, NBC News, reporting.
Bullshit.
Listen again on the hour when Ford, with 50 new models for 1970, brings you NBC Monitor News.
I recall one exotic night when at 7:01 all the lights went off in here. We went on the air at 7, and at 7:01 all the illumination went off. The pilot lights on the switchboard didn't go off, but you can't see much by those. And we had scripts, you know, to read and commercials to read. And for several minutes it was really black. No one smoked, you see. And then somebody found some matches, and there was one or two in the pack, just one or two. Meanwhile, screaming and yelling for flashlights, no flashlights. And the matches burned for a few seconds, went out, it was all black again. And then somebody got a flashlight, and then by that we could read on one microphone, and it took 20 minutes to get two or three flashlights, and the lights went back on about that time.
Progress is amazing. Now you and I are sitting here with two flashlights.
Yeah, aren't we? You got any matches?
No.
Well, I have a lot of memories of Monitor. It was I don't know quite what my contribution was in the early days. We covered a lot of fires and things like that when I worked in Chicago. My favorite recollection of it, though, is the total dedication of young NBC employees in those days, and the fact that they could sublimate their personalities to an extraordinary degree. We had interviews that were to have been done or were presented as interviews that Dave Garraway did. And for my sins, I got to do a lot of these interviews, and then Garraway would ask the questions, and they would play the tape, or I guess it wasn't wire in those days, of the answers I got from people, and my voice never appeared. And I got a call from New York one day saying, the interviews are fine, but they're not personal enough.
Mm.
And I said, well, what do you mean personal? And they said, well, have the people begin the answers with, well, Dave. So I tried this for a week or two and interviewed some people, and they kept forgetting to say, well, Dave. So I got a sign printed that said Dave and hung it around my neck. And in asking questions, I would point as they thought of the answer to Dave. And I guess we had the highest well, Dave rate at the network. Worked fine.
Everybody was happy.
Oh, yes. It was a different radio in those days. The country was different in those days. The country, 20 years ago, was discovering itself in terms of communication. Television and radio were performing quite different functions in an original way. And Monitor was one of the most exciting programs that I think I've ever heard in that historical context. And the reason for it was that it did tie up the whole country. It made you feel that you were a citizen of the United States, not just a Chicagoan or a New Yorker listening to a radio station, but for most of all of those weekends, you did have a feeling that the country was sharing and participating in a single enterprise, and that was magic.
Now, this is Sammy Kahn in Beverly Hills with a lyric to an old, old song for an old, old friend, Monitor. Monitor first came around in 1955. It's been a long, long time. And it had a brand new sound, 'cause Monitor was live. It's been a long, long time. And every doubter soon became a true believer. So here's a bow to our then-prez, Pat Weaver. For 20 years, old Monitor has managed to survive. It's been a long, long time. And we had communicators like Dave Garraway. It's been a long, long time. Clifton Fetterman, Frank Gallup, things to say. It's been a long, long time. And if you really want to speak of staying power, even way back then we had Ben Grauer. Men we think of with affection to this very day. It's been a long, long time. Nichols and Nate and Bob and Ray gave humor to the show. It's been a long, long time. And that Harry Golden with his southern Yiddish glow. It's been a long, long time. And when we needed raucous laughter for Phyllis, Monitor could count on Phyllis Diller. Marlena Dietrich's beauty hints were big on radio. It's been a long, long time. Then Steve White asked, could we write a 10th year birthday song? It's been a long, long time. So Sammy Kahn and James Van Heusen wrote the whole day long. It's been a long, long time. I can't believe that 20 years are now behind us. And it took four choruses to remind us. It's Auld Lang Syne for Monitor. So sing it loud and strong. It's been a long, long time. It's been a long time.
Well, thank you, Sammy Kahn. What do you say after that except thank you? It's time, my time, I guess, to say goodbye to all of you listeners who become friends of this program in its nearly 20 years of existence.
We leave you reluctantly. We leave you, we hope, with some indelible memories. We certainly have them. This is John Bartholomew Tucker, and you'll never hear this sound live at this hour again. This is Monitor on NBC. ¶¶